You're listening to This Week in Fantasy Baseball.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Fantasy Baseball. I'm Lee Keller, joined by John Kuh. In this episode, we are going to recap some of the hitter and pitcher performances from this past week, including Kyle Schwarber's three-peat home run day, a combined no-hitter by the Cubs, and Reynaldo Lopez's continued dominance. Also, we'll tell you about the latest news around baseball, like Corey Seager's unfortunate injury, and of course, give all of you some streamer recommendations at the end of the show. But before we do that, John, how's everything going? How's your fantasy landscape looking right now? Are you still in it? Are you still in some leagues in the heat of the playoffs? What's going on with you?
Yeah, my home league officially finished on Sunday. I finished in second, which I fully expected to happen, so good for me.
Yep.
It was kind of tough, though, because literally the last 2 weeks of that contest, I just had, again, basically starting from like day three of that matchup, I had no shot in competing. So, it was a slow death. To say the least. But I did find out last week that I don't know if you participated in Rad Slam this year.
Not this year, but I have before.
Yeah, so for those who don't know, Rad Slam is kind of like a pseudo-industry best ball league run by the guys over at Razzball. And I somehow made it to the championship in Rad Slam.
Oh, wow.
That's the best part about best ball leagues, right? You just don't really think about what's going on in them.
Yeah, you do the draft and you have no idea you're in it still.
Exactly. Like, I knew I had like a pretty solid team. Like, I was top three, I think, in my personal league for most of the year, managed to make it to the wild card round. But I mean, I had no idea. I think I might have even missed the second waiver period, to be honest. But yeah, I'm in the championship, which is basically the kind of the top 10 teams in Rad Slam. Unfortunately, I am firmly in dead last in this team. That's mainly because my pitching is terrible. I think the reason why I'm in the championship is because I took advantage of the week where Bobby Witt Jr. just went absolutely off.
Oh, okay.
And Vlad also went absolutely off. Unfortunately, Vlad's been pretty solid for the last 2 weeks. Bobby Witt Jr., not so much, has not been exactly a league winner. But my pitching staff is pretty terrible. Let me read off to you this staff, because most of them are either terrible or hurt.
All right, let's hear it.
So Reed Detmers, who actually came back and pitched this week. Incredible.
Yeah, amazing against the Dodgers, by the way.
Yeah, exactly. Aroldis Chapman, who now is the closer for Pittsburgh, so that's fun. Yeah. Klaase has been carrying my team a lot.
Okay.
Tanner Scott, which is unfortunate because Rad Slam only gives points for saves.
Okay.
JP Sears, who we'll talk about later in this podcast. David Bednar, who has now lost the closer role. I don't know. Yeah. I like lucked out with Aroldis and Bednar, I guess, working out.
Yeah, at least you had the handcuff. That's
right.
Good.
Jose Alvarado, who lost the closer job in Philly very early. Yu Darvish, who has just not been very good this year.
Yeah.
Framber. So Framber is like kind of the one bright spot.
Right.
And then Kyle Gibson, who is the Toby of Tobies. Not very good. Joe Ryan, who's on the 60-day IL.
Yep.
Max Scherzer, who's on the 15-day IL, but probably should be on the 60-day IL.
Yep.
Patrick Sandoval, who I believe got sent down to AAA.
Yeah, he hasn't pitched in a while.
Yeah. Shane Bieber, that did not go well.
No. Two great starts, then out for the year.
Two great starts, yeah. And then Blake Snell, who, even though we're not going to talk about him today, pitched one inning in his start today.
Not good.
Yeah. Two hits, one in run, two walks, two strikeouts. That was nice, but only got one inning out of him. And then Marcus Stroman, who also did not do very well.
No, he was bad this week.
Yeah, so my staff is either in AAA or hurt or not very good. and then there's Framber Valdez and a couple relievers. So it's tough, but at least my hitting is fine. I don't know. It's nice to at least be in like a championship thing, I guess, in September. I don't know. How's your home leagues going?
It's going well, thankfully. This is the final week of the regular season in my home league, and it's looking like I'm locking up a playoff spot. Things would have to go ultimately terrible for me to whiff on the playoffs. I would have to win 0 points, and the person in fifth would have to win 10. So I'm looking pretty safe for that, but I'm most likely going to finish in third, And then I'm going to play the same guy that I'm playing in the final week of the regular season in the first round of the playoffs, because the one seed plays the four seed and the two seed plays the three seed. Mm-hmm. And I happen to be the three seed and he happens to be the two seed. So we're going to go up against each other. It's my best friend in life, so it's going to be a fun matchup. We actually played each other in the finals last year where I got the best of him and I won. So it's going to be a fun little repeat. Right now I'm winning this week against him, but it only really matters next week. So my fingers are crossed for that. I'm in a little bit of a debacle. I was talking to John about this a little bit before we started the stream, and we decided that I don't know what to do between Taj Bradley and Ryan Pepiot, which one I want to drop. And it's tough. It's a 10-team league. It's a keeper league. So I could keep Taj. I could keep Pepiot in the last round. I'm probably not going to keep either of them. And their matchups are just not that great. And they just haven't been pitching that great. So my head's spinning a little bit. But hopefully we'll be able to make it to the finals at least. At least next week, I should be able to have an update of if I'm in the finals or not. And that'll be exciting. But I'm just hoping to get into the playoffs, maybe get into the finals and go for that repeat, because I won last year. I'd love to win this year. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, like you said, with best ball leagues, I mean, I did a double up league on NFBC for best ball. And like the whole year I've been in third, and it's just been awesome, because if I come top six, I believe it's the top five gets double their money and then six gets their money back.
Nice.
So I'm in third, and if I could just coast the rest of the way in third place, then I double up my money from that. And in another league, I'm also competitive. So it's looking like a profitable year again, which that's all you can ask for in fantasy baseball. If you're in money leagues, is just to profit. You want to win some leagues. You're not going to win them all, because that's just not how fantasy baseball works. But if you can win one or two leagues out of the six to eight you're in, you're probably profited for the year. So I'm very happy with how this year is going. It's been a fun year. It's been a lot of good memories and good moments. My Mets are on fire right now, which is incredible. Yeah. The Twins are looking pretty good for a playoff shot, most likely. So we have some good stuff to look forward to. So I'm very excited about baseball right now. We're in a good spot. But before we get into the rest of this show, just a reminder to all of you that you can follow our podcast on Twitter at ThisWeekPL, and you could send us your fantasy baseball questions to our email at thisweekplpod@gmail.com. Lastly, make sure that you subscribe to or follow the podcast on whatever streaming platform that you listen to your podcasts on. We're on all of them, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you listen to your podcasts on. So please make sure, if you don't already, that you follow us. And if you have the time, leave us a 5-star review if you enjoy listening to the show, because that would help us out greatly. So if you enjoy listening to the show, follow the podcast and leave a 5-star review. We would appreciate it greatly. Now, let's get into the news from this past week, headlined by an unfortunate injury. As I mentioned at the top of the show, we have Corey Seager of the Rangers, who was placed on the 10-day IL on Wednesday with hip discomfort. This injury seems to have been nagging Seager for quite some time, being that he's been out of the lineup three times in the last seven games. Originally, manager Bruce Bochy said that they'd be limiting Seager's playing time down the stretch, but it's obviously gotten to the point where they decided to just place him on the injured list. With the Rangers being out of playoff contention, Seager may not return for the rest of the season, so for all of the fantasy managers out there that have Seager, that is just a brutal blow to lose him for the next 2-3 weeks. John, do you have any shares of Seager, and what do you think about this? Do you think he comes back at any point for the regular season?
Yeah, I honestly don't remember if I have any shares of him. I don't think I do this year. I know last year you and I both had him in...
Yeah, I had him in a lot of places.
We had him in a lot of places. I know we both definitely had him in TGFBI.
Yes, we did.
Because we were both big on Seager, and of course he was out for that first month, which was really unfortunate, but he basically played like an MVP down the stretch. It feels weird to go on the 10-day IL because of hip discomfort, you know? Like,
yep.
That just feels like something you just say. We're like, we just want to give him rest, and we don't feel like competing too much. And the thing with the Rangers is, I mean, they're 5 games below 500. The American League is a pretty tough league this year in terms of trying to get into the playoffs. The Red Sox are a couple games behind. They're even at 70-70. The Tigers today, I think they won. I don't know if you saw Parker Meadows like hit a go-ahead grand slam.
Yeah, that was nuts.
To finish out the game. I'm not sure if they actually won or not yet.
They did, 4-3.
They did, 4-3. Yeah, so Detroit's been on a little bit of a hot streak there. I think they're 72-7 now. So the reality is that Texas is essentially, I think they're like 8 or 9 games out of the wild card with a month of baseball to play. That's pretty much impossible to overcome. So
right,
Seager going on the list now. Already, if Boshi is saying they're going to limit his time, I think it just, to me, if they want to kind of preserve the fact that this man's on a huge contract, they want him back next year, obviously. Maybe they just don't play him. It would be tough to see that happen, obviously, for fantasy managers. It might be the best thing for Seager just to be shut down for the next month. Obviously, he just played all the way to the World Series last season, so he's got a lot of wear on those tires. But, I think it wouldn't surprise me if he doesn't come back.
Yeah, it's very disappointing to see that he probably won't come back, especially because, like we said, the Rangers have nothing to play for. There's no need to push him to come back and just do nothing with him. So, unfortunately, I personally think that you're not going to get any use out of Seager for the rest of the fantasy season. So, if you have any shares of him, obviously just throw him on the IL. Don't cut him just in case he comes back. Unless you need to cut somebody on your IL, then obviously you can probably let him go, but I'd still try to hold on to him on your IL. But just unfortunate from Corey Seager, who we just expect so much out of, and he's had a really good year as well.
Yeah.
So hopefully he comes back next year strong.
Yeah, he's got a 353 OBP, 512 slugging, 30 homers still this season through 533 plate appearances. Like he has 30 homers through 533. Gunnar Henderson has 35 through 630. Bobby Witt Jr. has 30 through 621.
Wow.
So Corey Seager in 100 less plate appearances has as many homers as basically the two shortstops who are above him. Obviously, they've got a little bit better numbers in terms of the steals department, the runs department, and the RBI department. But Seager, for being on a team like the Rangers that has just kind of been on a little bit of a dud this entire season, still an incredible help to your fantasy teams. I think in Roto, you can kind of stomach this loss a little bit more. In head-to-head, this one hurts.
No, in head-to-head, this is brutal for sure. Yeah. And just in total for the Rangers to go from World Series champions to not even making the playoffs, I mean, that's brutal. So, I mean, they have had some injuries as well. Evan Carter's been out for like the whole season. Wyatt Langford didn't deliver on the extreme hype that he had. Adolis Garcia had a down year. Just a lot of things going wrong for the Rangers. I mean, that whole pitching staff got hurt, but we kind of expected that. The fact that they stayed healthy for the most part of last season is remarkable. So that's when it all goes right, but this is a season when it all goes wrong. So Rangers fans, at least you got a championship under your belt and you can stomach all of this badness from this season. But hopefully Corey Seager comes back strong next season and continues to be a top five shortstop for fantasy purposes. Moving on, we have Vinny Pasquantino of the Royals, who was placed on the 10-day IL on Friday with a broken right thumb. He underwent successful thumb surgery on Tuesday and is expected to miss 6 to 8 weeks. Vinny is optimistic that he'll be back this season, but he'd probably only be able to play if the Royals made a deep postseason run. His regular season is almost certainly over, and if you have any shares of him in fantasy, he is probably someone that you can also cut, which is disappointing because he's had a great season, was at the top of the board for RBI leaders, and he's been just great being behind Bobby Witt. So my personal home team is going to miss him greatly because he's been fantastic. Justin Steele of the Cubs was placed on the 15-day IL on Wednesday with left elbow tendonitis. There's currently no timetable for his return, but he'll miss the next 2 weeks at the least. Luis Robert Jr. of the White Sox left Wednesday's game against the Orioles with hamstring tightness. Robert hurt his hamstring while trying to beat out a double play. He'll most likely need further evaluation, but consider him day-to-day for now. Bryce Harper of the Phillies was hit by a pitch on his left elbow during Wednesday's game. He says that he's already feeling better, and he was also in the lineup on Thursday, so it seems like this isn't a serious concern. However, we found out that Harper has been playing through some right elbow pain recently, which has no correlation to being hit by a pitch on his left elbow. So he's clearly not 100% healthy, and it was kind of obvious the whole time that he was playing through something because he just hasn't been right. He hasn't been putting up the stats that we expect or that we're used to from Harper. So it's been kind of a down year for Harper when we expected big things from him. And I think if he's fully healthy, he's going to be 100% okay. But right now, something's off with Bryce Harper. Alec Bohm of the Phillies has missed 5 straight games due to a sore hand. It looks like he won't need an IL stint, but consider him day-to-day for the time being. Yoshinobu Yamamoto of the Dodgers will return to the rotation on Tuesday and start against the Cubs. Yamamoto only threw 53 pitches during his most recent rehab start, so he'll most likely be on a pitch count limit or innings restriction. So if you roster Yamamoto and you activate him for this, just don't expect him to get a quality start or go too deep into the game. Clayton Kershaw of the Dodgers was placed on the 15-day IL on Saturday with left big toe inflammation. Kershaw will need to wear a walking boot and is likely to require further imaging. There's no timetable for his return, but the Dodgers are hopeful that he'll return this season. Byron Buxton of the Twins suffered a setback during his rehab assignment with renewed hip soreness. Josh Naylor of the Guardians was not in Wednesday's lineup due to acute back spasms. Naylor is considered day-to-day for now. Gerrit Cole of the Yankees will make his next scheduled start on Sunday. There was concern that he'd be skipped after leaving his last start with a right calf cramp, but everything seems to be okay now. Austin Wells of the Yankees has missed two straight games after being hit with a pitch on his right hand on Monday. X-rays came back negative, and he is likely aiming to return on Friday. Lourdes Gurriel Jr. of the Diamondbacks was placed on the 10-day IL on Tuesday, retroactive to September 2nd, with a left calf strain. Ramon Urias of the Orioles was placed on the 10-day IL on Sunday due to a right ankle sprain. Reese Olson of the Tigers began a rehab assignment on Thursday. And last but kind of least, Paul Blackburn of the Mets will return to the rotation at some point during the Mets' series with the Blue Jays, which is September 9th to September 11th. But that wraps up all of the news from this past week. John, any last comments on this entire list?
Yeah, one thing I wanted to add about Bryce Harper was that he did get Tommy John on that right elbow.
Right.
So, yep. Not saying this is anything related. Obviously, Harper is a first baseman. He does not have to throw the ball as much as pitchers do. So, you know, this might not necessarily be related to anything related to the Tommy John surgery. But just the thing to be aware of, like, yeah, he's probably going to have to deal with this for the rest of his career, which is unfortunate. But just something to keep in mind.
Yeah, it's very unfortunate that Harper did have to go through Tommy John, and he kind of came back really fast, too, from it. So,
right. I think he got the modified version, right? Yeah.
Yes. So it's interesting to see that he is having renewed soreness in that right elbow after that, because we were all baffled that he came back so quick from Tommy John that we were like, oh my God, is he going to re-hurt himself? And he was fine for a while, but
yeah,
clearly something caught up with him.
Yeah, it's interesting in contrast to Shohei Ohtani, right?
Who right.
also got modified Tommy John, except he's a DH, so he doesn't handle the ball at all. Hasn't handled the ball at all this year in a game setting. I know he's been kind of doing some long toss here and there.
Yeah.
There's been some reports on that. But because Harper is playing first, there is, I think he throws left, though. Maybe he does throw right. He throws right.
I think
right.
he throws right.
He throws right. So there, there's maybe some opportunity for wear and tear even as a first baseman. But it is interesting to see, Shohei's had an incredible year this year. Obviously, he hasn't had to throw the ball at all. Harper yep. had a pretty solid year last year. I mean, this year, it's okay, too. He probably won't get to 30 homers. I don't know. He's four away, so it's still possible. But it has been a little bit of a down year for him, all things considered. But we'll see. We'll see kind of how the rest of his career shapes up if this right elbow is just going to be a thing that he has to deal with.
Yeah, I think just a nice long offseason will do him good. But unfortunately, the Phillies are leading the division and probably going to have an extended playoff run. So he might have to push himself and maybe risks getting re-injured, which that's not great. But he definitely needs some time off and to just rest that elbow, because I think time off will do him good. And I think for 2025, he'll be fine, obviously, unless something comes out. But I think he'll be okay. He just needs to rest up that elbow for sure.
Right, yeah. The National League race is, really close. They're tied with the Dodgers for the number one spot in the National League. The Brewers are only three games behind them. So, obviously, you want to get that first-round bye if you can. But then also, I mean, for sure for Philly, they definitely want home field advantage in the NLCS if they can make it there.
Yeah, and the crazy part about that, too, is the Phillies are leading the NL East. The Braves and the Mets are both eight games behind the Phillies.
Yeah.
And the Mets have a stretch where they play Philly seven times. So
oh, wow.
they can make up ground on them easily without anyone knowing it. They can kind of creep into the top. So if Philly's going through these injuries, if Harper's not 100%, if Alec Bohm is still out, if everyone's struggling, like if Trey Turner continues to struggle, if Kyle Schwarber doesn't go superhuman, like we'll mention later, they might lose the division. They might be a wild card team. We don't know. I mean, this NL East race is going to be very interesting for the rest of the year because to end the season, the Mets play the Braves in a series. Okay. And like I said, seven games against the Phillies. I mean, anything can happen. I'm not saying that the Mets are going to win the division, but anything can happen.
Okay, keep that hope. Keep that hope going.
Oh, that's as a Mets fan, we just have hopeless optimism. That's our whole shtick.
Yeah.
So
right.
You got to believe, right? That's the whole thing. So that's us. But we are going to take our first break now, and when we come back, we will begin to talk about the player performances from this past week. You won't want to miss it, so stay tuned. All right, we are back, and it's time to talk about the player performances from this past week. As always, we are going to start with Friday to Sunday, which is August 30th to September 1st. John, which hitters performed well?
Yeah, we are going to start with Julio Rodriguez, of course, of the Mariners, who... very interesting line, 1-for-2 with a homer, 3 runs, 2 RBIs, but 3 walks, which I think is actually pretty impressive. Overall for J-Rod's season, right, like he did miss some games because of injury in July, but he still has 121 on the year. And to show for that, all he has is 13 homers, 55 runs, and 48 RBI. Now, Seattle kind of has gone in a little bit of a free fall, right? They were leading the NL West for a really long time. But then they pretty much lost. I think it was like a 9-game lead over Houston or something like that. And now they're on the outside looking in on the playoff picture. And so the entire team just has been in kind of a slump, and J-Rod's has been part of that issue. If you do want some optimism, he has 20 steals on the season. That's nice. But his slash line is a career low. Now, granted, he's only been playing for 3 years, so it's not that hard to set career lows. But it is a little bit disappointing that he's kind of been regressing a little bit since that rookie season. For some other optimism, he was raking before he got hurt in July. In August, while he hasn't been as prolific, he still has his second highest monthly OBP of the entire year. So, some things are nice. I think when we look at J-Rod, I think it's like we expect a player who has an OPS over 800, right? An above average player. That's kind of the guy that we expect from J-Rod. It's why he gets picked so high in drafts. I think the last year's 30-30 season made us think that, hey, there's something here with J-Rod that like maybe he can be like one of these generational elite players, right? Obviously getting Rookie of the Year was already really helpful to establish that. But then having a 30-30 season, that's huge. And I was just looking at 30-30 seasons. Who has a lot of them? Funny enough, it's Bobby and Barry Bonds, who are both tied for 5 seasons.
Wow.
With 5 30-30 seasons. The fact that J-Rod already has one, and he's only 23 years old, there's a possibility he could get there. I think 25-25 has been maybe a little bit more realistic in terms of expectation. Barry actually leads has the record book of that for 10 25-25 seasons, which is also kind of insane.
Yeah.
But J-Rod, yeah, I think every year we draft him with the expectation he's going to go 25-25. He already has 2 25-25 seasons. That's why he's a top 5 pick every single year. I still like him in the middle of the first round when I think about 2025 drafts as opposed to the end of the first round. I think this season, yes, it wasn't very good. Yes, the numbers and the ratios are pretty bad. But I think there is no reason to believe that this is who J-Rod actually is, right? I think for sure he's still going to be a guy who has that 25-25 potential, who could give you a 30-30 season. And that's going to be the way I see him in the offseason. And this season, even though it hasn't been as good, I think let's just kind of write it off and move on. Another young player to talk about, Will Wagner of the Blue Jays, went 5-for-6 with a double, a home run, 3 runs, and 2 RBI on Saturday. I had the personal misfortune of attending this game. Toronto destroyed the Twins 15-0. That was a very fun game to be at as a Twins fan. Since being called up on August 12th, Wagner is slashing .350, .371, .550. That's in 62 plate appearances. So, yes, this Twins game on Saturday was 10% of those appearances. That being said, though, he's been pretty solid for the other 18 games. The thing with Wagner is that he's not necessarily a huge power hitter. He actually set his career high on Saturday with 8 homers in a year. That's set over AAA and the majors. The high slugging percentage that he has is a little bit of a smokescreen. He's batting .328, so only has a .188 ISO. Still, if you're looking for a hot hitter, Wagner could certainly provide that. He's got good average. Yes, and the OBP is high enough because he keeps hitting. Toronto is essentially trotting out like a quad A roster most days. Well, it's a quad A roster that features Vladimir Guerrero Jr., so a little bit different there. But it just isn't very good. So I think Wagner is going to get still a lot of opportunities down the road. They got for him in a trade from Houston this year, so they're probably motivated just to see, like, what do we have in this guy. So if you need a little bit of a boost in your lineup and you have an extra spot, Wagner might be an interesting option to look at. And then finally, Jordan Walker of the St. Louis Cardinals, 5-for-5 with a homer, 4 runs, 3 RBI, and a stolen base on Sunday. I'd name a more annoying prospect situation this past month than how the Cardinals have handled Jordan Walker in August. He was the opening day right fielder, but after 20 games, they sent him back to AAA. He finally got called up again August 12th, but then had limited playing time with the Cardinals choosing to only use him against lefties, and then he was only up for a week. They sent him down to AAA again. They brought him up last Friday, and now the Cardinals are saying that he is going to have an everyday role. So don't know what's going on with Ollie Marmol and the Cards with how they want to use Jordan Walker. He took full advantage, though, of this new opportunity. He went perfect at the plate on Sunday, as I mentioned. He added on a combo meal. The thing with Walker is that his minor league stats don't necessarily inspire confidence. He's only had 9 homers this season in 84 games at AAA. He's at a .263 average, which is fine. But there is so much more potential in his bat, right? He's got great power grades. He's only 22 years old. If you want to try your luck, he's 26% roster at Yahoo, 9% on ESPN. He clearly has some power. He just really hasn't necessarily been able to show it this season. He did have 16 homers last year, so there's something there in his bat. Hopefully the Cardinals stay true to the word and have him play most games going down the stretch. So if you need outfield help, like if you're in a five outfielder league or NL only league, definitely take a chance on Walker if you have a shot, because he could provide some really good things down the stretch.
So for Julio Rodriguez, I'm kind of shocked that you still believe in him as a first-round pick, because I was doing a little bit of, not planning, but just, I guess, research on who would be the top 10 for the first round. Like, yeah, who are the definitive top 10? And there is at least 9 names that I would like over J-Rod. Mm-hmm. And that's without diving deeper and adding in, like, Corbin Carroll or Jarren Duran or those kind of guys. But I think there's 9 definitive guys that mm-hmm. you would take over J-Rod. So that immediately puts him towards the end of the first round in most drafts. So for me, I consider him more of a second-round pick. Like, I think if he's there in the middle of the second round and you want to gamble that he's a 30-30 guy, same with, like, a Fernando Tatis almost. Like, those two guys, I think, are going to go very similarly in drafts because they give you the same sort of upside, but we don't know what they're going to give you at any given time. Tatis is extremely injury prone, and then Julio Rodriguez is so random. I mean, this season, he's got all lows across the board in batting.
Yep.
He batted .284, .345, .509 in his rookie season, then went .275, .333, .485, so a little bit of a decrease, but still a great season. I mean, he had 32 homers, 37 steals, yep, played pretty much every game. That's amazing. You take that slash line any given day with those stats. But then this year, .258 average, .316 OBP, and .370 slug with only 13 homers and 20 steals. So it doesn't really inspire any confidence that I want to take him in the first round, because if he gives me 20-20, that's fantastic. That's a great player. Mm-hmm. I love that for fantasy.
Right.
But in the first round, I don't know. I think there's better options out there that can give you more than Julio can. So he's a tough one. He might be a close call. Depends how he finishes the year, how he looks in spring training. Just the growth of Julio will be interesting to follow, because anything can happen with this guy. He could be an absolute superstar for years to come. But he also could fall short and have seasons like this where they're good, but they're not first 2-round fantasy good, you know? So
yeah, that's
Julio's
fair.
Julio's going to be a tough call. He's going to be a tough call for me. I love him, though. I think he's a great player.
Mm-hmm. And I think the tough thing is, like, are you drafting him based on his last season, or are you drafting him based on potential, right?
Yes.
Because if you're going to say, like, hey, Julio's a 25-25 guy, right, just, like, in a vacuum, right, I think you take that guy in the first round. Right. Because that's, like, that's Kyle Tucker territory.
Yep.
Who else? Like, that's, like, I mean, I'm not saying Lindor's kind of playing his way into being a first rounder.
Oh, yeah. He's a 30-30 guy. I mean, that's like 2 seasons in a row. He's going to be 30-30.
Exactly. So I think there's, like, some interesting ideas there where it's like, hey, the steals are pretty solid. Like, the steals at least haven't gone down dramatically, right?
Right.
The homers have gone down just a little bit. He did hit another one today, so he's at 14 now.
Right, correct.
If he finishes the season at 2020, and we know it's a down year for him, right? Like, does that bump you up to make him think, like, well, if he's a 25-25 guy, and if I'm drafting Kyle Tucker at, like, let's just say pick 6 or something like that, am I also thinking J-Rod at that spot?
That's a great question because, first of all, Kyle Tucker is an interesting one because, yeah, I think they're very similar player profiles, but Tucker's lineup construct is so much better than Julio's lineup construct. So the fact that I know Tucker's probably going to score 100 runs and get 100 RBI with that 30-30 season or 25-25 season,
right,
it gives me way more confidence to draft Tucker 6th overall or 7th overall, whatever it may be.
Yeah.
For Julio, it's not the same. I mean, the lineup around him is tragic. I mean, literally tragic. Like, him and Cal Raleigh are the only signs of life. Maybe Randy, a splash of him there. Victor Robles a little bit. But everyone else is terrible. So I don't feel as good about that. But if Julio finishes this season with 20 homers and 25 stolen bases, gets the average up to 260, I'll definitely feel good about him at the end of the first round, start of the second round.
Sure.
Like, that would give me confidence to be like, okay, I'll gamble on him being a 30-30 guy, being that this was his worst season. Because, honestly, 20 homers and 25 steals for Julio would be his worst season. I mean, the rookie year, 28 homers, 25 steals. The next year, 32 homers, 37 steals. So there's clearly an outlier where he was worse. I mean, it's only a 3-year sample size, but there's a clear outlier there. So I will give Julio his flowers in regards to I won't drop him to the third round, you know what I mean? But I think the ceiling there for Julio is very large. So we'll have to see what he finishes up with to fully give him that. And I won't talk much about Will Wagner. Will Wagner's been great. He looks a lot like Dalton Varsho. I just want to make that statement because I was watching the game and he stood in the box and I was like, oh, Varsho's up? And my friend was like, that's not Varsho. I was like, that looks like Varsho. He goes, no, that's Will Wagner. I said, oh, it could have fooled me. So that's cool. And then Jordan Walker, you mentioned an interesting thing where he's been up and down this season.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is because he was playing every day to start the year. Then he really struggled. So they were playing him every other day. And they thought that that was really bad for his growth, that he was playing every other day. So they sent him down to AAA specifically so that he can play every day and get his confidence back.
Right.
So they did that. They fully played him every single day. And like you said, his numbers weren't that great in AAA. He only had 9 homers in 84 games, 263 average. It's not like he was setting the world on fire. But now that they're calling him back up, they were really just carving out a path for him, I guess, during the trade deadline to let him play every day. They got rid of Tommy Pham. They got rid of Tommy Edman. They're kind of letting Jordan Walker grow his wings and fly. And hopefully he takes that and runs with it and really shows us who he can be, because last season he wasn't bad. He's got incredible prospect pedigree. We know what he's capable of, but he just hasn't shown it yet. So hopefully this unlimited playing time here with a job that he can't lose really proves something to us, and that we can draft him next year and be excited about him, because I was very high on him going into the year and then he immediately let me down. So hopefully Jordan Walker can get back on track.
All right, moving on to pitchers. We're going to talk about J.P. Sears first. Going up against Texas, gets the win on this one on Friday. 7 innings with 1 run, 5 hits, 2 walks, and 4 strikeouts. Sears is a very interesting pitcher. I mean, I've mentioned this on the podcast before. He's kind of a PLV darling. PLV loved him at the beginning of the season, preseason specifically. And it's interesting when you look at his stats, because he doesn't have very elite stuff in terms of just, like, raw numbers, right? Like, strikeout rate's not very good. His ERA is not really good. His whip is fine. But then you just look at, like, how he uses his pitches. His bad pitch percentage is a 26.4%. His average pitch percentage is 25%. Both of those above the 93rd percentile. Basically, all that means is he doesn't throw a lot of bad pitches, and most of the pitches are, like, fine. He doesn't have a lot of elite pitches, but he avoids mistakes. That's in the 68th percentile. It's got above average PLA. And all those things kind of mushed together kind of just means that he's all right, right? He has some really, really good starts, and he has some really, really bad starts. And his ERA on the season, 4.21. The whip, 1.21. Both of those, the ERA is bad. The whip's like about average. Strikeout number is pretty terrible. I think it's like 18% or something like that. His walk rate's fine, though, and that usually means because he's letting all these balls in play happen, that doesn't result in more runs for him and bloating his ERA even more. At the end of the day, kind of you know, along with what Nick says, you know, basically Sears is the cherry bomb. He can have very, very good starts because he doesn't throw a lot of bad pitches, but then he can have a lot of bad starts because he just doesn't strike anyone out. Clearly capable of doing things, but just because he can't strike out, those results in some bad outings. Moving on to Saturday, I'm going to talk about Matthew Boyd of the Cleveland Guardians, going up against Pittsburgh, 6 innings, 1 earned run, 4 hits, no walks, and 8 strikeouts. In his 4 starts this season, this is easily Boyd's easiest opponent in Pittsburgh. Worked out very well. He got 10 whiffs on his changeup. Did a very good job in avoiding the middle of the plate, nibbling on the edges. The problem really is that his fastball doesn't inspire any confidence. But if he can avoid making mistakes with that pitch and he doesn't leave his secondaries hanging, he's capable of pretty good things. That being said, though, we're recording this on Thursday. On Friday, he's going up against the Dodgers. That's going to be scary. But then after that, he gets the White Sox, which could be a fun little stream for all you Boyd boys. And finally, Bailey Ober on Sunday, my boy, going up against Toronto. 6 innings, 1 run, 1 hit, 3 walks, 8 strikeouts. I'm actually amazed that Bailey Ober got as high as 6th on Nick's last top 100 list. I remember a guy when I've watched Bailey Ober the last 4 years, pretty solid, nothing spectacular. This season, he actually has had worse numbers compared to the 2023 season, but he seems to have much more consistency, evidenced by his 16 quality starts. He did have like a streak of like 9 or 10 straight quality starts. So really solid season for Bailey Ober. Now, he did lay an absolute egg against Atlanta the week before, but this week he absolutely cooked against the Blue Jays. He finished with 12 whiffs overall, had 5 on the fastball, 5 on the changeup. Yeah, Ober's been one of those guys who, you know, has been probably a league winner for most of you guys. Similar, I mean, obviously not on the level of Chris Sale, but on similar level to Chris Sale, where, you know, you probably get him for $1, $2 pretty late in drafts, and he's absolutely returned more than what you expected from him. And yeah, shout out to Bailey Ober for just being really solid in his 4th major league season.
Yeah, JP Sears, first of all, was someone that I was very interested in all season long because, like you said, his stuff isn't like amazing, but he's a PLV darling. And that kind of opened my mind to what he's capable of and what he's doing. And he's been on a pretty good run as of late. I'm kind of disappointed in him because I streamed him just recently, I believe on Wednesday against the Mariners, expecting a quality start, expecting like 8 strikeouts. And he did go deep into the game, but he gave up 4 earned runs. So it wasn't that great. I think it might have been 5 earned runs.
I think it was 5. Yeah. It was not good.
No, he just had 1 bad inning, to be honest, where he just got taken deep a little bit. So unfortunate for JP Sears, but he's been really good this year. And it's cool to see that Oakland has been great. They've had like the 2nd best record since like July. And that's incredible to think about. Like, the A's, they're putting together winning games. I don't understand. It's just, it's pretty crazy. So shout out to JP Sears. He's been the rock of that staff, and he's just been very, very good. So JP Sears is a name that's definitely interesting for streamer side of things. Same with Matthew Boyd. He's just a really good streamer right now. He's been really good since he came back, since he joined the Guardians. I like what he's doing. Definitely don't start him against the Dodgers. But then he gets the White Sox, like John said. And that is a start that I want to stream him in because that is a tasty matchup right there. And then, yeah, Bailey Ober has been so consistent this year that it's been honestly incredible. He's only had like 3 bad starts. But the problem is those 3 starts were like 900 earned runs.
Yeah.
Where it was so bad. But besides that, he's been awesome.
Yeah. And it's funny because obviously his first bad start was like his first start against Kansas City. And then he went up against Kansas City again. I think I can't remember. It was like a month later or something like that. Absolutely got wrecked again. And then, yeah, last week against the Braves, that was not pretty to watch. it was pretty bad.
No. Yeah.
But in his defense, like that game, it was like 91 degrees. It was super muggy. Like the ball was just flying out of the park, but yeah, he's had 3 bad starts, but the rest of his starts have been incredible.
Yeah, he had that stretch where he was getting quality starts every single time. So, yeah, Bailey Ober has been a league-winning sort of pitcher. So if you have Bailey Ober, good job, because he's been a great pick. I know Nick was hyping him up all year. He was putting him high on the list to start, and he's really delivered on that. So shout-out to Nick, and shout-out to Bailey Ober. Moving on to Monday, September 2nd, thanks to Jonathan Metzeler for the Churio Toodaloo hitter recap article. We start with Freddie Freeman of the Dodgers, who went 2-for-3 with 2 home runs, 2 runs, 5 RBI, and a walk. Surprisingly enough, Freeman has had a bit of a down year this season and has battled little injuries throughout the entire season. As of recent, he's dealing with a hairline fracture in his finger. However, he's heated up as of late with 4 home runs in 4 games, including this 2-homer performance on Monday. Freeman's slash line is a bit lower than we're used to at 288, 382, 495, but he still hit 21 home runs, has 83 RBI, and 74 runs scored. Freeman remains as one of the top 3 first basemen for fantasy purposes, especially with that stacked lineup around him, and like I mentioned, it's a down year for Freeman with a 288 average, so it just goes to show how good Freddie Freeman actually is. Then we have the title boy himself, Jackson Chourio of the Brewers, who went 1-for-2 with a home run, 2 runs, 4 RBI, and 3 walks. Chourio has really turned it on in the second half. A fun little stat that Jonathan mentions in the article: after this game, where Chourio hit a grand slam, he joined Ted Williams, Mickey Mantle, and Alex Rodriguez as the only players with multiple grand slams before their 21st birthday. Pretty incredible. Chourio has probably been the best rookie hitter this season, alongside fellow first name Jackson Merrill. In the second half, Chourio has had a 162 WRC+. He's hit 335, and his strikeout rate is at a very low 14%, which is phenomenal. Just one homer away from a 2020 season, Chourio looks like he's the real deal, and he'll probably go within the first 5 rounds of fantasy drafts next season, so Chourio's got a lot of hype. He's got the potential to be amazing for fantasy, and he's already showing us that this year. And then lastly, shout out to Shea Langeliers of the Athletics for going 2-for-4 with 2 home runs, 2 runs, and 4 RBI. Just a solid game out of a top 15 catcher for fantasy. His strikeout rate is actually lowered, and his power is legitimate, so he might be someone that you want to target late in your drafts next season. And I don't know when he becomes a free agent, but usually when Oakland Athletics catchers are good and have a lot of power, they get traded to the Braves for next to nothing. So Shea Langeliers might be very good for another team sometime in the future. So shout out to you, Shea Langeliers.
Yeah, I'm a big Shea guy. I'm a big fan of Shea. Second amongst all catchers with homers with 25, like you mentioned. Fun, of course, the best part is that Cal Raleigh is first with 28.
Yep.
So gotta love Big Dumper just kind of ruling that lead. But yeah, Freddie Freeman, I think interesting thing with him, I was looking at kind of row projections. He's the 4th best first baseman based in roto leagues. Of course, the reason why he's fourth is because Salvador Perez has first base eligibility, right, which is kind of fun. But yeah, the fact that a bad season for him is like 288 with 21 homers is kind of funny. Because yeah, it's like we kind of expect him to be like kind of hitting like close to 300 almost, right? That's kind of what we expect from Freeman. Nearly like, you know, 30 homers if we could get it. But yeah, I mean, injuries, things like that. He's getting a little older. It happens. But I think he's still pretty much like exactly the guy you wanted in that spot, right? Like, he's going, what, end of first round, early second round? That's probably where Freeman was going.
Yeah, that's probably his location.
Yeah, he had a pretty high ADP last season. I was looking it up. It was like around 9 or 10. So a little bit higher, a little bit elevated than probably he will be next season. But still, like, the average homer combo with Freeman is so good that and he's so consistent with that, too. That's kind of the main thing. It's not just like a flash in the pan. It's consistency with him that, yeah, it's hard to not want to pick him up. It'll still probably be going in the same spot next season, right? Probably start of second round is where I have Freeman. I think Vlad's made a big jump this season, in my opinion, to kind of taking over that first baseman spot.
Yeah, it's pretty easy to say Freeman will be an end of the first round or beginning of second round because of especially that lineup context. I mean, Ohtani, yes, Betts, Freeman. You can't get much better than that. And then following Freeman is like Teoscar Hernandez and Will Smith. And it just goes on and on and on and on. So the fact that Freddie Freeman is in that lineup batting third every single day, he's going to score 100 runs, get 100 RBI, hit 20 homers, and bat 300. I mean, that is as surefire of a fantasy contributor that you can get.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And speaking of good team context, is Jackson Chourio. Obviously, we just mentioned the Brewers are third in the NL pennant race. So really good team around him. Willie Contreras has been an absolute monster as a catcher. Christian Yelich was great for like the 2 months that he was playing.
Yep.
but yeah, the rest of the Brewers team has been pretty solid. Willy Adames is a top five shortstop. So Jackson Chourio in that lineup context, like, yes, he was batting like eighth or ninth to start the season, but he's really come into his own, which I think is cool to see for a guy who is as young as, like, you know, we mentioned, he's the fourth player with multiple grand slams for his 21st birthday.
Yep.
That's kind of nuts. But yeah, I kind of agree with you. He's going to be pretty high up in drafts next season. And I think a lot of, he might even be a little bit more elevated than he should be, because there's kind of like the whole like buyer's remorse thing. Like, I didn't pick him up as a rookie. I really should pick him up as a sophomore. And yeah, hopefully he has a really good season next year too.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think he is going to be a little bit juiced up in the standings there, because I also think that he's probably worth a fifth round pick.
Mm-hmm.
Probably that. I could see him going like in the third or fourth round for people that are just like, I need to have Chourio. That 30-30 upside is tantalizing. Like, if I'm taking Julio in round two or three, I got to grab Jackson Chourio in round four or five. Like, I could see it being elevated a little bit. So that's definitely interesting to see. Moving on to pitchers from Monday, thanks to Nick Pollock for the Out of the Woods SP Roundup article. We'll start with Joe Musgrove of the Padres, who went 6 innings, no earned runs, 3 hits, 2 walks, and 8 strikeouts against the Tigers. Why do I always find myself talking about Joe Musgrove? We have such a love-hate relationship, but I'll mention your really good performance today, Joe. You win. Musgrove had a King Cole on Monday with his 37% CSW, and his curveball not only returned a 50% CSW, but it wasn't hit into play once all game. Musgrove's schedule for the rest of the season is pretty chill as well. He gets the Giants twice, the White Sox once, and then the Diamondbacks to finish things off. If you roster Musgrove, it's full steam ahead for the rest of the year. I expect only good starts from Musgrove from here on out. I know there was a lull in the beginning of the season, and then he got hurt, and we were kind of worried about Musgrove, but he's clearly just a great pitcher. And then next, we have Gavin Williams of the Guardians, who went 7 innings pitched, 1 earned run, 1 hit, 2 walks, and 6 strikeouts against the Royals. This was a really strong start from Gavin against a good offense in Kansas City. Williams has such a great arsenal, headlined by an incredible four-seam fastball. He just needs to command his cutter and curveball fully to tap into the potential that we know he has. The curveball in this start was dominant, with 7 out of 26 whiffs and a 50% O-swing percentage. Williams gets the Dodgers next, though, so it'd probably warrant a sit from me, but then he gets the Rays, the Twins, and the Reds, which I definitely start him for those matchups. So Gavin Williams, if he's available on your wire, which I doubt he is, but if he is, he's got 3 good matchups coming up after that Dodgers start, so keep an eye out on Gavin Williams. And then lastly, I just wanted to shout out Gerrit Cole, Luis Severino, and Jack Flaherty, who all had great starts on Monday, but we've talked about all of them recently, so I didn't want to do a full write-up for them.
Yeah, we talked about Musgrove last week too, so I won't really belabor the point there. But yeah, that's a really nice schedule for the rest of the season. Gavin Williams, man, he's super interesting because the ERA is pretty high, right? 4.55, and that's like, you can't really chalk that up to like, oh, it was, you know, coming off the injured list, he wasn't 100% there. Like, he's had some pretty bad starts in August as well, but the strikeout ability, I think, is what I'm kind of most impressed by, because starting out of the gate, he had pretty pedestrian strikeout numbers.
Yep.
But then, yeah, he's been kind of ramping up a little bit to the point where he's got a 25% strikeout rate, which isn't necessarily elite, but it's still 75th percentile, right? That's really, really good. And I'm kind of curious, you know, like if Cleveland can kind of work some magic with him over the offseason, clean up you know, the walk rate, for example. The strikeout rate's already pretty good as it is, but like you mentioned, you know, maybe tap into that cutter, tap into that curveball. If they can get those things going, like, this guy has top 30 pitcher potential.
Yeah, absolutely.
All around.
Yep.
Him because of his strikeout numbers, right? Because he has that strikeout ability, that's what makes him that like potential ace. If he didn't have that, like, then yeah, he's kind of more in the 50s with kind of just his, because of the ERA problems, really, and the walk problems. But yeah, I think there's something there where he's going to be a guy to look at in spring training for sure, just to see, like, hey, how's he looking in these games? Does he look like he has the command going? And if he does, you know, that makes him a very interesting pick in drafts next year.
Oh, without a doubt. Gavin Williams has a lot of potential, and if he could just tap into those pitches and refine that arsenal, he can be a really good pitcher for fantasy. I expect great things, especially since he's on the Cleveland Guardians, which seem to have a well of pitchers that they just drink from the fountain of youth that are amazing. So we'll hopefully see good things out of Gavin Williams soon. But we're going to take another break, and when we come back, we will talk about Tuesday and Wednesday's player performances. We'll be back after this. We are back, and it's time to get into Tuesday's performances from September 3rd. John, who performed well on this day?
Yeah, thanks to Mark Stubiger for the Chicken Schwarba hit a recap article. Great one there. I loved it. We're going to talk about title boy Kyle Schwarber, who just absolutely went bonkers on Tuesday, 5-for-6 with a double and 3 home runs, 4 runs, and 6 RBI. Schwarber is probably one of my favorite players. I always love seeing how he's doing. I'm extremely disappointed that I had pretty much 0 shares of him this season in my drafts. And he now joins Lawrence Butler, who we talked about last week, as the only players with multiple 3 homer games this season. In 5x5 leagues that score with OBP instead of average, Schwarber is the 11th best roto batter and the 3rd best outfielder. So hopefully if you have him in an OBP or a slugging league, you've got Schwarber. This is also the 6th out of 10 seasons where he's finishing with at least 30 homers, the 7th season with an 800 OPS. If not for injuries earlier this season, Schwarber could have been knocking on the 40 homer club like he did last year. That being said, though, he's still on track to finish with 100 plus runs and 100 plus RBI. He's just been so good, right? And it's always easy to think that, like, oh, like, Schwarber's, like, over the hill, he's going to start regressing. And, like, yes, his homer numbers are a little bit lower this year, but I think that's mainly due to injury. I think if he wasn't hurt, he'd clear 40. And, yeah, he's just so much fun. And I'm still never great, the whole leadoff Schwarber thing. But you know what? It's worked for the last 3 seasons, so there's definitely no reason to stop now. And then Francisco Lindor of your Mets, 2-for-4 with a double, homer, 2 runs, 3 RBI, and a stolen base. I was kind of surprised. We have not talked about Lindor enough this season, probably because all we could think about was how slow his start to the season was. But he's been a very solid player when you look at his season in its entirety. He got to 30 homers in Tuesday for the 5th season in his 10-year career. And while he's not completely on pace for 100 runs and 100 RBI, he's really close. I would not be surprised to see him get there. Like you mentioned, he also has a bunch of steals. He's a 4th best shortstop in terms of 5x5 roto rankings. I personally would put him 3rd best in head-to-head leagues because the steals he offers you on a week-by-week basis is about as helpful as the 3rd-place guy, who is Ellie, right? I think the steals that you get from Lindor are enough to win your league on a week-by-week basis, just as Ellie's steals obviously help you win on a week-by-week basis as well. So shout-out to Lindor, who's just been absolutely cooking the last 2 years. I think showing how the doubters wrong, obviously he had a really awful first month of the year, but really has turned around since May. And there's been a lot of fun talk on Twitter about, like, who should be the NL MVP, whether Shohei is, like, I'm not going to ask you because I know you're probably a little biased on that, but I think there's a really interesting argument there on who should be the MVP, whether it's Shohei, who obviously has been doing absolute work as a DH, or whether it's Lindor, who's been doing it on the field as a defensive shortstop, but also at the plate, just as a 30-30 guy.
So I'll quickly touch on Kyle Schwarber before I get into that whole thing right there.
Yeah.
So Kyle Schwarber, just incredible. We say it every time you mention Kyle Schwarber, but him being in the leadoff position is insane because he would have probably over like 110 RBI at this point if he was just the 2 batter or the 3 batter or the 4 batter. So it always blows my mind that he's still a leadoff guy, but what a game from Schwarber. I mean, 2 3-home run games this year is so impressive. So shout out to Schwarber, who always gets it done and is a monster. I mean, a monster in OBP leagues, like you said, and points leagues and anything that takes into consideration walks. Schwarber is an animal. So I'm sure if you play in that format, you already know that, but just make sure that in your format, if you do consider walks in any way, Kyle Schwarber is probably a top 5 outfielder for you. And then Francisco Lindor, we really haven't spoke about him much on the podcast, which is kind of shocking. He's had an amazing year, and it's baffling to me that he wasn't even an all-star this year. Brandon Nimmo wasn't an all-star this year, which they both deserve to be. I don't know why they weren't. I don't know why Lindor wasn't, for sure, because
Who was the all-star from the Mets?
It was Pete Alonso. And
It was because
he was in the Home Run Derby. They wanted him to be an all-star to compete. Like, they said, I'm not going to compete if I'm not an all-star, because he's going to be a free agent. So he wanted that on his resume, that he was an all-star in 2024 and was in the home run derby. So I think that really took away from who should have been there, which was Lindor and Nimmo. And Pete was having a fine season, but not as good as Lindor and Nimmo. So
no, yeah,
that always shocks me. But Lindor is a guy that is always criminally underrated. He always starts the year really, really slow, and we know that now. We know who he is. It's just like Blake Snell. He's not as good in the first half as he is in the second half. It's a lot of these guys do the same thing, and Lindor has been doing this for a while now. But now that he's finally settled into New York, he embraces the culture. He understands it. It's his team almost. He's like a co-captain with Brandon Nimmo and kind of Pete involved there too. But Lindor's finally comfortable, and we can see that. And this season, he's been incredible. And to the debate, which is a debate that is just New York-wide. If you live in New York, you are pretty much debating if he should win the MVP. And a lot of people are biased because, obviously, anyone I ask is probably a Mets fan. Even a Yankee fan, they'll go, oh, yeah, no, Lindor should get it. He's a defender as well. And I am also in that camp where I think that since there is multiple awards, right? Like, I'm a firm believer that there should be one single award for the most talented player. And Shohei Ohtani, if healthy, should probably always win that because he's a pitcher and a hitter, right? Like, unless something magical happens from someone else and Ohtani has a down year, there should be a most talented player. Now, there isn't that award, but there is an award for hitting called the Henry Aaron Award. And by far, Ohtani and Judge are having the two best hitting seasons by any player across the board. So for AL and NL Henry Aaron Awards, I don't know if it's both leagues, that award. I don't know if it's specifically NL.
I think
NL
it's both.
Or
I think
it's
both.
Yeah, I think it's both. So if it is both, then obviously Ohtani should win it for the National League and Judge should win it for the American League. But when we're talking about an MVP, okay, you really have to boil it down to value, the most valuable player. Now, what Ohtani is doing is otherworldly. I am the biggest supporter of Shohei Ohtani. I think he is the best player in baseball. I think he's the most talented player in baseball. I think no one can do what he can do. But with that being said, he is strictly a DH this season. He does not have to do anything but grab a bat, swing it, and do whatever on the base paths. He doesn't have to play defense. He doesn't have to pitch. He's not doing anything but designated hitting. Mm-hmm. Lindor is playing every inning at one of the most premium positions and is a gold glove type shortstop who has been incredible all year long. And without Francisco Lindor, the Mets would not even be close to sniffing the playoffs. Without Shohei Ohtani, the Dodgers probably lose a few more games. Absolutely. But the Dodgers are still the Dodgers. They would be fine without him. I mean, not fine because losing Ohtani is a big blow. But
yeah. And Mookie was out for a good chunk of the season.
Correct. And Freddie missed some time. I mean, they've had their injuries, of course. Yeah. But Shohei Ohtani is easily the best hitter. But if we're talking about most valuable player, most valuable to their team, most valuable to each side of the ball, then I have to give it to Lindor just because he's going to go 30 homers, 30 steals. He has an 850 plus OPS. His F-WAR is higher than Ohtani's based on where you're looking for F-WAR. I just think Lindor all around on all sides of the ball, playing every single game this season, playing the field, hitting, leading the team, on, off the field, getting the Mets into contention, I think he really is deserving. Now, I think it's going to be closer than we think. I still think Ohtani wins it. But I think that the old head voters are really going to factor in Lindor's defense more to the equation than we're thinking. And I think that Lindor might be able to steal it, but I think ultimately Ohtani wins it. And honestly, Ohtani's deserving, but Lindor really has a case.
Yeah, it's been the first time that the old folks, the like anti-sabermetrics guy, are going to like care about defensive WAR in the, in their rankings, right?
Yeah, it's a real debate. I mean, no DH has ever won the MVP. So,
yeah.
I mean, are we just going to add another thing to the mantle for Ohtani, first to do this, first to do that? Like, and also, it's kind of just another thing, and I know we're ranting about this a little bit too long, of course. We'll end it after this, but obviously Ohtani's going for something that no one's ever done, 50-50, but no one's done 44-44. He's already done that. When he goes 45-46, whatever, no one's done that. Everything he does, no one's done that. Like, at what point do we just go, okay, these are all arbitrary numbers. Let's look at fielding metrics, and let's look at actual impact and wins above replacement and all of the other things, because everything Ohtani's doing day in and day out is miraculous and something we've never seen before. So I get it. I totally get it. But you got to give Lindor a little bit of credit here, because the fact that he's even in the conversation with someone that is possibly having a 50-50 season is impressive to say the least.
Yeah, I will say for Lindor's sake, like he's kind of on pace to get to 30 steals.
Oh, yeah, easily. Right? He will get
there. He's four away. Yep. There's 22 games left of the season. I'm assuming the Mets are playing him every single day from here on out.
Oh, absolutely.
So he should be able to get to 30 steals.
And he leads off, too. He's definitely going to get 30 steals. I can guarantee that almost.
He just needs like a game where he gets two steals, and I think then it'll be like a done deal that he'll get to 30 by end of season.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. But we've ranted about this for far too long, John, so get us into the pitchers for Tuesday.
Yeah, sounds good. Thanks to Nick for the Warcade Fire article. Love that. We're going to start with Cade Povich of the Baltimore Orioles. 7.1 innings, no earned runs, 5 hits, no walks, 10 strikeouts against the Chicago White Sox, who were the most Chicago White Sox team possible in this game. just going to shamelessly take a victory lap as well, because we recommended this as a streaming option last week. That being said, Nick also had him as a probably start, too, in his starting pitcher ranking, so I'm not going to be too cocky about this one. That being said, though, right, he's against the White Sox. He gets 10 strikeouts. How accurate of Povich's skill was this start? Again, White Sox. He got a lot of strikeouts via called strikes. He had 25 total called strikes, which is kind of insane. A few of those were just dead on middle, and just guys just were just, I don't want to go after that. He stole 7 strikes with his curveball and had 13 called strikes on a 0-0 count. Now, that number is like not that surprising. Pretty much most called strikes are on 0-0 counts because guys don't like swinging at the first pitch, a la Joe Mauer. But again, some of those were also just dead center. So this might have been just the White Sox being the White Sox. He does have a very intriguing two-start week. He's got a start on Monday at Boston, then a start at Detroit. The Boston start's a little bit scary, obviously, because Boston is still a team that is going for the wild card. They're pushing real hard. But at least Povich is a lefty, so he kind of neutralizes Fenway a little bit because of that. Against Detroit, they're a surging team, but they're still not a great team, right? They're not like an elite offense just yet. I think if you have Povich in a daily league, I definitely have him go against Detroit. Maybe skip that Boston start. But if you're in a weekly league and you have to make a decision, do I take advantage of the two-start week? I'm really not opposed to having him in that two-star week as well. Yes, the Boston start's a little scary. He's got the win chance behind him, obviously, because of Baltimore. He's not going to get 25 called strikes against either of those teams, but I think this stuff is pretty solid for him. The only scary thing is that, like, again, a lot of his pitches were just like dead center in the zone, and I don't know. It's a little dicey on how good he can really be against like a good team. But that's why I think you should probably sit him against Boston and play him against Detroit if you're in a daily league. Moving on, another Met, David Peterson, going up against Boston, got the win in this one. 6 innings, 1 earned run, 6 hits, 1 walk, and 11 strikeouts. We recommended Peterson as a streaming option a couple weeks ago, but honestly, I didn't actually realize how good of a season he's been having. He reached double-digit quality starts for the first time in his career. He's got 10, and he also has the 11th best ERA in the league with a 2.75. Of course, that's where the numbers start to not look as great, because the whip's not great. The strikeout rate has actually taken a severe dip this season, dropping from 26% to 19.5%. So where's the differences here? How is Peterson actually doing well? Well, in previous years, even though he's actually had a higher ground ball rate, his BABIP's also been pretty high. He had a BABIP above 300 between 2021 and 2023 each of those seasons. This season, he's got a 289 BABIP, so just a little bit lower than that. But that's league average, and that's helped a lot by the defense behind him. He's got a 3.99 FIP and a 420 XFIP. So, honestly, even though he's having a great ERA, because of how bad all the other numbers look, this is kind of luck, right? We were just talking about Francisco Lindor being one of the elite defensive guys in the league. Well, he's right behind David Peterson, and probably a reason why a lot of those balls in play that he's allowing, all those ground balls, are ending up as outs and not hits. Do you still trust him in the final month? I don't know. He gets Toronto next week, which can be somewhat dangerous, but they are still kind of a quad A team. And then he gets the Nats, which is a team that has a bunch of rookies on it. I would at least keep him for those two starts. After that, the Mets schedule gets a little nuts. Like you mentioned, they've got 7 games coming up against the Phillies. He's going to have to start one of those. So it's a little dicey, but yeah, David Peterson having a really solid season. If you look at his ERA, everything else, a little scary, but his next two starts, I think, are worthy of trotting him out on your fantasy teams.
Yeah, so little round of applause for us for Cade Povich. Obviously, when we recommend somebody that gives a start to 7.1 innings pitch, no earned runs, and 10 strikeouts, even if it's against the White Sox and it's cheating, then, you know, we deserve a little bit of a flower there. So Cade Povich, excellent job. Thank you for making us look smart. And then David Peterson, yeah, he's been very good this season. And as you mentioned, it's a lot of luck. He looks good out there, but he is giving up a lot of hits, a lot of walks, and his whip is really high. And you kind of can see it in the numbers. You can really tell when someone's kind of faking it. And Peterson looks like that on paper, where it's like, this something is off, you know?
Yeah.
It doesn't look right. I mean, he's been great. I mean, 11 strikeouts against Boston, he's doing something right. Like, when he clicks, he is good. But on those starts where he doesn't have it, that's where he's being saved by the defense, and that's why the numbers look as good as they do. Yeah. So shout out to Peterson for doing this well. I definitely start him out there for the Toronto and the Nats, but the Phillies and the Braves, that's going to be a little bit tougher. Maybe not the Braves. I would start him there. The Phillies is the one that's kind of tough, but even they have been struggling a little bit offensively outside of Schwarber. So maybe you just start him the rest of the year. I mean, when you've been that good, why would you not start him, right? Like, until he shows you otherwise, just keep trotting him out there. Because if he has a bad start, then, oh, well, you knew it was coming at some point. But if he just keeps rolling like this, you don't want to miss out. So I would start David Peterson across the board.
It is interesting comparing these two guys, because Cade Povich got his 10 strikeouts with 11 whiffs. And like I mentioned, 25 called strikes.
Right.
David Peterson got his 11 strikeouts with 20 whiffs.
Yeah.
So a little bit more interesting sort of makeup there. I tend to trust guys with that gift more whiffs, obviously, because that's a bit more repeatable than the called strikes. But yeah, David Peterson, that strikeout rate dropping kind of surprised me. But then again, he has an 11th strikeout game against Boston. Something is going right.
Yeah, oh, without a doubt. And honestly, the 25 called strikes for Cade Povich is unbelievable. I don't even think
I've heard
a number like that.
It is actually really funny.
Yeah, I don't remember even number close to that at any point in the season. That's ridiculous. I mean, shout out to the White Sox. Did you see the call, actually, when the two fielders collided into each other?
100%. The White Sox are going to White Sox.
Yep, the White Sox are the most White Sox version of themselves. It's like, oh man, what a good call. That's funny. But
yeah,
moving on to Wednesday's performances from September 4th. Thanks to Scott McDermott for the Under My Umbrella Ellie hitter recap article. We'll start with Dansby Swanson of the Cubs, who went 3-for-5 with a double, a home run, 2 runs, and 3 RBI. Swanson has been unreal for the better part of a month now. In the month of August, Swanson hit .261, .340, .443 with 3 home runs, 8 stolen bases, 21 RBI, and 19 runs scored. Then so far, 5 days into September, he's been hitting .556, .579, .1000 with 2 home runs. Mainly batting 7th in the Cubs lineup, Swanson has been red hot and has made patient fantasy managers very happy. Swanson was actually dropped in my home league quite some time ago, and I was debating on dropping Jeremy Peña for him, but I felt like it was a lateral move in the grand scheme of things, that they're too close of players to do that. And then Swanson was picked up by someone else that's in the playoffs, so hopefully I don't regret that move, but we'll see, because Swanson has been otherworldly. He's been so good. And then we have Victor Robles of the Mariners, who went 3-for-4 with 2 doubles, 3 runs, 3 RBI, and a walk. Robles is another guy that has been pretty hot. He's been particularly good since the change of scenery to Seattle. Since August 27th, Robles has scored 9 runs, drove in 8 RBI, hit 1 home run, and stole 5 bases. He's not someone that I'd rely on every day, but right now, he's been solid, and there's no denying that. So if you're in a 5-outfield league or need a boost in stolen bases, you should definitely pick Victor Robles up.
Yeah, Dansby, just looking at players in August and September, right, like you mentioned, pretty solid numbers for him. Like you said, 3 homers, 8 stolen bases. I think the 21 RBI 19 runs is pretty pretty clear, like, that's huge. Because this Cubs team, like, they kind of waved the white flag just a little bit during the trade deadline. And so that was a team that could have very easily just been like, all right, we just don't care. We're not going to try anymore. But Swanson and Seiya Suzuki, who we've talked about on a couple of podcasts, both have been really solid players in the past couple of months. And hopefully that's like a good thing for fantasy managers next season to see. But yeah, also the problem with Swanson is just he's batting so far down in the lineup. I was just looking at year-to-date numbers. Swanson's like the 20th best shortstop. He isn't super fantasy viable, but I think in deep leagues or, you know, leagues where you have shortstop and middle infielder spots, Swanson is still very much capable of providing good numbers there. So, yeah, hopefully it doesn't bite you in the back to not have picked up Swanson. But, yeah, he is a guy who is droppable, right? But he's also a guy who, like, probably in, like, a 12-teamer with shortstop and middle infield spots should probably be on a roster as well.
Yeah, without a doubt. Like, in my home league, it's a 10-team keeper league. The rosters are a little shorter. There's no middle infield spots. So, you know, if you swap out Dansby Swanson for a hotter shortstop, then you can't be blamed for it because Swanson was having a down year up until this hot stretch in August. So it makes sense.
Yeah. And then, yeah, Victor Robles, like, shout out to him for, like, completely turning around his career with the Mariners.
Yeah.
Just, like, went from a guy who was basically a complete afterthought when he was with the Nats, right? Is that correct?
Yep.
And then I just remember, like, I think it was, like, 2-3 years ago, DVR on, of course, with the Athletic and on their fantasy baseball podcast, loved Victor Robles on Rates and Barrels, and he just never amounted to anything. You know, it always felt like a joke, right? It's like, oh yeah, Victor Robles got a lot of potential, but just isn't going anywhere. But yeah, shout out to him for kind of turning around the season, like being one of the few bright spots on this Mariners offense, like we talked about before. It's kind of just J-Rod and Cal Raleigh, and then now Victor Robles joins that group. So good for him. Like you said, though, still kind of a fringe outfielder. If you need that boost in stolen bases, kind of a good mercenary to pick up from time to time. Yeah, still probably not an everyday guy, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, just to give you a little sample size, since he joined the Mariners, he's played 59 games for them. And in that span, he's hit 306, 360, 453 with 4 home runs and 18 stolen bases. So that is a pretty good stretch, and he's really reinvented himself in Seattle. Yeah. So you love to see it. He's kind of cashing in on that prospect pedigree that once was. I mean, remember when Victor Robles was, like, more hyped up than Juan Soto?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's wild. That was a real thing. Like, that happened.
Yeah, well, it was like, this guy's got, like, again, otherworldly speed. He's got a little power, you know, like, this guy could be like a, you know, I think at that time we didn't have the concept of like what a 2060 player could be.
Yeah, right.
Now Ellie has become that guy. Like, I feel like, I'm not saying we were thinking Victor Robles was going to be like a 2060 player, but it was like, this guy's got a little power and he's got a lot of speed. So it was a little fun.
Yeah, no, absolutely. He was definitely highly touted. Moving on to pitchers from Wednesday, thanks to Nick Pollock for the last of Marcus SP Roundup article. We start with Zach Gallen of the Diamondbacks, who went 6 innings pitched, 0 earned runs, 0 hits, 4 walks, and 8 strikeouts against the Giants. Gallen pitched a gem in this one, going 6 innings without allowing a hit. This season, Gallen has been very up and down. The stats look good on paper, but it's not what you expected from a pitcher that was being regarded as a top 10 to top 15 sort of guy. His ERA is 3.69, the WHIP is 1.28, and he has 126 strikeouts in 127 innings pitched. He's pretty much just been a definitive mid pitcher. He's been a guy that is an SP 3-5 for fantasy and not really an ace. Hopefully, Gallen can finish the year strong and give us a reason to believe in him as an ace for 2025, because we have seen that out of Gallen, specifically last season. And I think that the long postseason for Gallen really taxed his arm for this year, and I don't blame him for struggling. So I think that if the Diamondbacks make the playoffs, then this kind of is null and void. But if they don't, I think if he has a long and nice offseason, it'll be good for him. But it's looking like they're going to the playoffs, and he'll probably be taxed yet again. So we'll see how Zach Gallen's recovery process goes, but hopefully he can get back to being an ace. And then we have Mackenzie Gore of the Nationals, who went 6 innings pitched, 1 earned run, 1 hit, 1 walk, and 9 strikeouts against the Marlins. That makes 3 straight good starts for Gore. The offenses that he's gone up against haven't been bad either. The Braves, the Yankees, and the Marlins. Sure, the Braves are a little depleted and struggling a bit. The Yankees have only 2 real threats. And the Marlins aren't too tough, but they still aren't easy matchups. None of them are a give me, and Gore has been very good. This start specifically was the best version of Gore, though. The heater was at 96 to 97 and located up in the zone, while the secondaries were a little wild but around the bottom of the zone. He most likely has a 2-start week next week against the Braves and then the Marlins, both repeats from what he's had recently, so you might want to deploy him for those because he already had good success and good numbers against those two teams. Might as well roll the dice that he does it again. And then lastly, shout out to Shota Imanaga of the Cubs, who went 7 innings pitched, no earned runs, no hits, 2 walks, and 7 strikeouts against the Pirates. Just like Gallen, Shota gave up 0 hits, but in 7 innings pitched, and then combined with 2 relievers, they were able to complete the no-hitter. So big shout out to Imanaga and the Cubs on throwing a combined no-hitter, and Shota just being an overall beast this season. His name is now in the record books. He could be a Rookie of the Year candidate, although Paul Skeens and Jackson Merrill are probably ahead of him, rightfully so, but Shota has been great this season, and he's everything you could have asked for a rookie pitcher coming over from Japan.
Yeah, I was thinking kind of when you were talking about Gallen, you know, where would I put him in rankings, and kind of exactly what you said, right? To me, he's like a top 40 guy, but he's not a top 20 guy. Right?
Yeah.
Like, yep. he's not even like a fringe ace. He's on the fringe of being a fringe ace right now with the season he's happening, right? And we know the potential for Gallen is that he is an ace, right? He can be a top 15 pitcher, but the season just hasn't been able to get there. Just the kind of consistency has been really tough. And he's in a really good division, right? He's got to play the Dodgers. He's got to play the Padres, both who are really, really solid teams. Of course, the Giants make it a little bit easier, and the Rockies obviously make it super easy. But it's a tough division. Obviously, long postseason. It looks like the Diamondbacks are going to the playoffs too. So, it is kind of worrying to see, like, if he has back-to-back long postseasons, right? We're not going to say the Diamondbacks are going to actually make it out of the wild card, but they are the best offense in baseball right now, which is kind of funny. If they make it to the division round, right? That's 2 more starts at least for Gallen, maybe 3. And it's a lot to ask for a guy who, you know, had already pitched a lot last season. So hopefully he's able to get some rest in the offseason. Mackenzie Gore, I don't know, his numbers have been very interesting. He did have a little bit of a dud against Philly, but overall just really, really solid numbers. And I would like to see that entire I just like to see, like, we got some progress right at the beginning of the season for Gore, and then it kind of petered out, and then we're back again. I think if he can finish the season at a really solid pace, right, he's a guy who is easily someone who I'd consider for like top 40.
Yeah,
right?
Me too. Yep.
Because he was there, right? He was there at the beginning of the season. Then he just absolutely crashed, and now his ERA and WHIP are just unspeakable. But if he finishes out the season strong, I think that gives me a lot of hope for next season, right? There's always the thing of, like, with drafts where it's like it's easy to look at the person's season in totality when we look into the past, but like remembering where guys were in August and September, like were they on hot streaks? Were they feeling good? That does carry over a little bit into March, right? It is a new season, so there's kind of a reset, but like if you're feeling good, if your pitchers are in a good spot, that still means that in come March, come April, right, you kind of know what you're doing, and that allows, you know, managers really to feel a little bit more trustworthy in picking up a guy.
Yeah, without a doubt. And Gallen, one more comment on him is that he's only pitched 127 innings this season because he's been injured every now and then because of that long postseason. So if those innings keep adding up deeper into the playoffs, it's just going to be so taxing for him. So hopefully he can not get too taxed to the point where he injures himself and is never the same. So yeah, I agree with that. And I also agree with Gore. If he can just end the season strong, we already believed in him going into the season. He showed it to us, and then it disappeared like Houdini. Like, it was gone as fast as it came. And hopefully, if he finishes strong, we can have faith in him as a buttoning ace rather than someone who's just a streamer you know, so hopefully Gore can live up to those expectations. But we are going to take our last break, and when we come back, we will talk about Thursday and the streamer recommendations for the next week. You won't want to miss that. Stay tuned. All right, we are back, and it's time to talk about our last performance on Thursday, September 5th. John, who did well in this one?
Yeah, we are going to start off with Luke Raley of the Seattle Mariners, 3-for-5 with a run, 2 RBI, and a homer today. Raley showed some promise last season in Tampa Bay, but unfortunately just really couldn't get consistent playing time, with the Rays limiting his at-bats to being against only righties. As soon as a lefty came in, he got yanked out of the lineup. He was great in those moments, though. He had 17 homers and 47 RBI in those at-bats against righties. Unfortunately, moving to Seattle has not changed at all, even though I'm sure many of us were kind of hoping that he would get more consistent playing time in that trade. He's still pretty much a platoon player. Now, when he's a even as a platoon player, he's still solid. He's got 15 homers, 40 RBI. He's got a 786 OPS. But it really doesn't ever look like he's going to escape being a guy who faces only righties. And that makes it challenging to trust him day in, day out. Since as soon as we get to a pitching change, Seattle is likely to take him out of a game. So we're not even necessarily guaranteed, you know, 3 or 4 at-bats for Luke Raley because of just how poor his performances are against lefties. And then Adolis Garcia of the Texas Rangers went 1-for-3 with 3 RBI, 1 run, 1 walk, and a homer. The Adolis Garcia redemption tour continues. After 3 months with a subpar OPS and a batting average below the Mendoza line each month, since August, Garcia's has an OPS of 729 and an average above 250. Now, of course, those are not elite numbers. They're not even really above average numbers, as he only has had also just 4 homers in August. The more important thing is that there's improvement. Now, I don't know if we're ever going to get another 25-25 season from Adolis, right? That was the very tantalizing thing. That's why people loved picking him up in drafts. But there was also kind of the risk of like, well, he only did it one season, right? And so I think that's why he hasn't been as highly coveted as a guy like Kyle Tucker, for example, even though the context around Garcia has been really nice with, you know, both Corey Seager, with Marcus Semien on his team, other young players, you know, Nate Lowe, this year with Evan Carter and Wyatt Langford. He just hasn't really had the same velocity as other guys have because he's really only done it once. That being said, though, I still think a 30-15 season is something I would consider him capable of reaching next season. His numbers this year aren't necessarily going to get close to that, but I think that's still something that is potentials for him. I don't think it's necessarily something that I would say, like, I would put in if I was going to just, like, guess on what his numbers were going to be next season. It's like, I'm not going to say Adolis is a 30-50 guy, right? Something more realistic is, like, maybe 25-10 or something like that. But 30-15 is very much something he can grasp, and I would definitely consider that as maybe, like, the high end, the 90th percentile performance that Adolis has. And if he does that, and I'm willing to risk it in drafts, right, there's kind of a good thing that he's then going a little bit later because you kind of get a little bit of a steal in the later rounds.
So Luke Raley is definitely someone that in daily leagues you want to take advantage of because, like you said, yes, he is a platoon bat. So if you can have him on your bench in a deeper league and you can plug him in a daily league whenever he's playing, then you could take really good advantage of him because he's very, very good against righties. But against lefties, he's not good. He sits. It's just not a good mix. So in those daily leagues, he definitely deserves consideration when he is against a right-handed pitcher. And then Adolis Garcia, yeah, it's such a down year for him, and it's so weird because at points in this season, he really showed promise. He showed that, hey, this is who I am. I mean, I remember one week where he hit like 3 home runs, had 9 RBI or something. Like, he was going off, and I was like, oh, here comes Adolis. Like, it's turning on, and then just fizzled out. So he's very strange, where I think he's one of the guys that eventually will get to the point where he hits 35 homers a season and steals 3 bases, where he just stops running completely and then the power goes up. Maybe something like that happens. I also see him as like a 25-15, 30-15 kind of guy for right now, and I think it's going to be good next season since he had a bad year. I think there's going to be value in drafts for him the following season because, once again, the team he's on is good. They just came off of a World Series run. They won, and now they're kind of depleted. The energy there is kind of deflated. They've been hurt. They've been injured. They've been playing bad. I think next year Texas really shines when everyone's healthy again. The camaraderie is back, and Adolis can shine again because I just think they're all taxed. And that's so hard to say when you win the World Series and you make that long run that the next year is kind of bad. I mean, we've seen teams be good after winning the World Series, of course, but for some players is different, and it looks like it really taxed Adolis. So hopefully we see good things out of him next season and he can finish this year strong.
Right. The frustrating thing about Adolis was that March, April was really good. 8 homers, he had 4 steals, .292 average, right? And it's like, oh yeah, this guy's back. Right?
Yeah.
Like he's gonna hit. I mean, of course, like, we're not gonna say he's gonna hit 50 homers, but
no, we thought 40-20. We thought 40 homers, 20. 20 steals. We're like, oh, this guy's a value. Like, oh my God.
Yeah, exactly. And then that he couldn't bat up with the Mendoza line for 3 months.
Yep. So,
it's a little tough there, but it's kind of interesting, the idea of, like, you know, obviously, like, as fantasy players, like, health is a big part, right? Because, like, we just mentioned, Corey Seager has a sore hip and he might be out for the next month, right? I'm not bitter about that at all. but you have guys like Evan Carter, like Wyatt Langford, Wyatt Langford played a full season of college baseball and then a minor league season, and then he went to the World Series, right?
Yep.
Like, the dude played a lot of baseball last year, so it's not that surprising that he's kind of tired this year, right? Same thing with Evan Carter, played a lot of games last year. It's not surprising that this year hasn't been as great. Now, does that mean that next year is going to go well for them? Not necessarily, right? But having a major league season under your belt, knowing what it's like to be a big league player, I think the fact that the Rangers didn't necessarily give up on both those guys, right? They were willing to kind of work through them through the pains and the struggles. I think it's going to be key for next year when that outfield is going to be real scary, right? And Adolis is going to have better players around him. Frankly, the whole team, like you said, it's going to be probably in a better spot health-wise, and that's going to be really interesting to see how they compete in the AL West and just how these players do in terms of fantasy stats as well.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see their growth and how they progress for sure.
Yeah. All right, moving on to pitchers. We're going to start with Ronaldo Lopez of Atlanta. Went up against Colorado, went 6 innings with 5 hits, 2 earned runs, 11 strikeouts, but still got the loss in this one. Kind of frustrating. Lopez went 4-seam slider, and that's all he needed to get the quality start. The 11 strikeouts came thanks to 8 whiffs on the slider, but also 15 called strikes on the 4-seamer. Unfortunately, just couldn't get any run support from his own team. The offense was shut down by Austin Gomber, of all people. And this game was also in Atlanta, so Gomber, you know, being able to deal with not being in that Colorado air, maybe was feeling a little something. That all being said, Lopez has been absolutely elite this season. 2.04 ERA, 1.15 whip, a 9.59 K per 9. His walk rate's not great, but the transition from reliever to starter has worked out probably better than anyone would have imagined. Definitely Atlanta. And I would expect Lopez to be a pretty hot commodity in drafts next season. There's still kind of maybe some worry about consistency. Like, is he really going to be a top 40 guy? But the way he's pitching, it's incredible. Yes, he was out for injury for a couple weeks, which is why his numbers are kind of down in terms of his innings and the counting strikes. That being said, though, he's been so good this season. I think it's definitely repeatable next year. And I'm very interested to see, like, where he goes in drafts and whether people actually trust him in his second year as a starter. And then Rhett Lauder of the Cincinnati Reds went up against Houston. No decision, 6.1 innings, 4 hits, no one runs, 4 walks, and 3 strikeouts. Of course, this was his second start as a rookie. If you're a Peel Pro member, you have access to the fastball shape sheet, which gets to look at fastball from each starter live each day, grades them. Now, Lauder, right, this is his second start. He was kind of considered the second best pitcher in last year's draft behind Paul Skenes. So very hyped in terms of a prospect. Kind of the unfortunate thing was that he went to the Reds and we're like, why is this guy pitching in Great American Small Park? Why do you do this to us baseball gods? His makeup is interesting. He's got a slider, sinker, four seamer, and changeup. Kind of uses them all equally. Doesn't really force one over the other. Nick mentioned in his write up last week on Ladder that the problem with him is that he doesn't love the fastball shape. And the reason I mentioned the Peel Pro fastball shape sheet is that if you looked at it today for this start, the fastball still didn't grade out very well. The velocity isn't great. It's reasonable. It comes in at 94 miles an hour. In today's, you know, baseball era, you would prefer to see that come in 95, 96. But some guys still succeed with a 94 mile an hour fastball. His IVB, his induced vertical break, which is basically how much vertical rise or kind of implied vertical rise do you get from a pitch? It's not stellar either. 14.9. Usually you want to see that 15, 16 inches. 17 inches is good. 18 inches, that's considered elite. Basically, it's how flat is your fastball. Ladders is not very flat. That being said, you could still succeed with a not flat baseball called Joe Ryan, for example, has got like a 12.9 IVB. He's got like a 93 mile an hour fastball. But you've got to have a really interesting fastball then to work. And the problem is Lauder does not have an interesting fastball. He also has poor extension, and he's just kind of got a weird delivery. All that being put together means he doesn't have a good fastball. But then do you really want a guy who's like a sinker slider guy? You know, maybe in Great American Small Park, maybe it makes sense to be a sinker slider guy. I was looking at Nick's write-up. He wasn't a big fan of that, and I kind of understand, right? It, you know, it is kind of the fastball slider is really kind of the thing that everyone loves nowadays. So you want to have a good fastball. Unfortunately, Lauder doesn't have that. The good thing for Lauder is that the slider is really good. If it's located better instead of being in the zone, I think it's a legit whiff pitch. I think if you look at his pitch breakdown for this game, it's kind of hilarious on where his sliders are. Like, they're pretty much like all in the zone, which I find really funny. So that's why I got a bunch of called strikes on it today. If you can kind of work on the fastball over the offseason, right, clean up the delivery just a little bit, like, he does have a lot of potential. But maybe he doesn't have to do that. Maybe it all works out and we don't know what we're talking about, which is definitely possible. The fact is, his second start of the year of his major league debut, he had zero earned runs against Houston, which I think is pretty solid. I don't really know if he's viable in fantasy for the rest of the month, but it is interesting to see him do this, to succeed in this way. And it's going to be fun to see where he goes in drafts next year.
Yeah, both of these guys are very interesting. Reynaldo Lopez, obviously the transition from reliever to starter has been interesting. And once again, as I always say, of course, Atlanta gets the best version of Reynaldo Lopez that we've been waiting on for years to come through. So Reynaldo Lopez has been excellent. I think it's past the point where we can be like, oh, it's Reynaldo Lopez is going to regress. He's going to do bad. He's just great, and he's been very good. I don't think he's going to be a top pick in drafts. I think he's going to go high, which might cause me to have zero shares of him.
Yeah.
But I think he's going to be a very serviceable pitcher, not a 2 ERA pitcher, but I think he could be a very high twos to a mid 3 ERA pitcher, and even that is fantastic. I mean, that's what you're getting out of Zach Gallen right now. And right now, if I asked you who would you rather, Zach Gallen or Reynaldo Lopez, you'd probably still say Zach Gallen. Meanwhile, Reynaldo Lopez has been better. So I overall would like Lopez later in the draft. So if I can get Lopez at like the 9, 10, 11 round range rather than the probably what he deserves, like 6, 7, 8 round range, that's where I would like to live. But I think Reynaldo might get pushed up the boards, especially in wins leagues being on Atlanta. So he's going to be an interesting one come next season. And then Rhett Lauder has been great in the minors. I mean, he was flourishing down there. And like you said, he was one of the top pitchers in the draft behind Paul Skeens. And he's shown some really good stuff. And that fastball, like you said, is not elite by any stretch of the imagination. But that's something that you can improve on. I mean, look at what Hunter Green has done in the offseason on what he's been able to do with his fastball. He was a guy who just aimlessly threw 103 with no command, and it was flat. And then he went to driveline and re-imaged his whole fastball and his whole approach and his slider. And look what he's doing now. So the fact that they're on the same team, maybe he can help him out as well. So I like Rhett Lauder's future. I think there's a very promising chance for him to be great next season. And the schedule is honestly pretty good for the rest of the season for him. After this Houston start, he has the Cardinals, then the Twins, then the Pirates, and then the Cubs. So that's a pretty good schedule. And if you want to take advantage of that, then by all means, I mean, stream away. But Rhett Lauder is someone you should definitely keep on your mind, because I think that he's going to be good for next season as like a late round sleeper pitcher if he has a spot in the rotation. So Rhett Lauder, definitely look out for him. But that wraps up the player performances from this past week in this very long episode of This Week in Fantasy Baseball, but lots of good stuff. And before we head out, we have our streamers for next week, of course. So John, let's get right into that. What pitchers are you recommending to stream?
Yeah, I already teased this a little bit. Matthew Boyd, 25% roster at Yahoo, 11% on ESPN. Again, he's got the tough test against the Dodgers that happens on Friday, so right before this podcast comes out. Assuming he gets dropped like a rock in leagues after that, I think he's going to be very available for his start against the White Sox on Wednesday. So that's one of those games where Being on Cleveland, he's definitely got the win chance there. Cleveland has let him go six innings of the last two starts, so quality start possible there. We also just saw what Cade Povich did to the White Sox, so Boyd could have a pretty good strikeout game too as well. So this is one of those starts where, like you said, I feel like if you're in a daily league, it makes absolute sense to pick up. Even if you're in a weekly league, I think it makes a lot of sense to pick up. We're going to talk next about David Festa, my boy on the Twins, 16% on Yahoo, 5% on ESPN. Festa's had a very good couple outings. When I got to the Rays, went up against Atlanta. Unfortunately, both of those starts ended in losses, but it really wasn't Festa's fault. It was just the fact that the Twins didn't give him any sort of run support. He gets the Angels next week on Monday, and then if you look at roster resource, it says that he doesn't get Seattle, but it's because they think that the Twins have a six-man rotation. I personally think they're going to go back to a five-man rotation for at least next week. So I think he gets Cincinnati on Sunday at home in Minnesota, so not at Great American Ballpark. So assuming he gets that two-start week against the Angels and Cincinnati, I think that is going to be just a really good week for Festa. He's got very good strikeout ability. He has a 29% strikeout rate, a 13.7 swinging strike rate, and a 30.7 CSW. Again, this guy's just a rookie. He's got really good stuff. I think he's legit, and I think he's got two really good win chances next week. And then finally, Luis L. Ortiz, 25% on Yahoo, 8% on ESPN. This kind of feels like cheating just a little bit because I mentioned Ortiz last week, and the start we recommended you to pick him up for technically has not happened at the time of recording. It happens tomorrow against the Nationals, I believe. But last Saturday, he did throw six shutout innings against the Guardians. Now he gets the Miami on Wednesday. The week after that, he gets the Cardinals. It's tough because the win chance isn't there because, after all, he plays for the Pirates. So it's kind of like a 50-50 toss-up when you play these poor teams. But I do think that ultimately Ortiz helps ratios in those starts. And again, those are weak teams, right? Miami, the Cardinals. If you want to, you know, wait a little bit, see how he does against the Nats, that's totally fine. I just think that this is like a really good opportunity to pick up Ortiz and see how he does.
Yeah, this is an interesting list for sure. I think I would choose them in the exact order you listed them off in. I would go Boyd, Festa, Ortiz. Maybe Festa over Boyd. I really like Festa's stuff. So I like that. And I just like the fact that Matthew Boyd goes against the White Sox, right? Like,
yeah,
that is
exactly
just so free that I can't really rank him any lower than one. So
yeah,
Matthew Boyd has the potential to just shut down the White Sox with a lot of strikeouts. And I think if you're chasing a good one-off stream, then just go for Matthew Boyd. But then David Festa I like a lot. And then Luis L. Ortiz, we've mentioned him a few times as a streamer, and he's pretty good. So I like that recommendation as well. Now for the hitters, I'm going to recommend just one name, and I've already spoke about him in this podcast. It's Victor Robles of the Mariners. He's got outfield eligibility, of course. He's 14% rostered on Yahoo. And as I mentioned earlier, Robles has been hot. And right now, in this point in the season, you just want someone who's hot. He's batting either leadoff or ninth for the Mariners. And although that team is struggling in general, Robles is flourishing. Like I said, in 59 games with the Mariners, he's batting over .300. He has 18 stolen bases. I mean, that's all you can ask for. He's stealing bases frequently, scoring a lot of runs, and has the occasional homer. If you're in deeper five outfielder leagues, or even in shallower leagues that you're lacking stolen bases in for roto or head-to-head, I would grab Robles and just see what you get from him, because he's been great ever since joining the Seattle Mariners. He's been looking fantastic. So if he's out there, which he probably is since he's not very highly rostered, then by all means, go and pick up Victor Robles. But that wraps up this episode of This Week in Fantasy Baseball. Before you all click off, make sure that you follow us on Twitter at ThisWeekPL and send us your comments and questions to our email at ThisWeekPLpod@gmail.com. You can find John on Twitter at TheJohnKe, that's THEJOHNKE. And you can follow myself on Twitter at Regicidal, that's REGICIDAL. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to the Pitcher List podcast feed and this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you listen to your podcasts on. And please leave us a 5-star review if you enjoy listening to the show. Lastly, sign up for Pitcher List Plus. By doing so, you can join us in the Pitcher List Discord and get advice from all of the fantasy experts and writers over there. Make sure you go to pitcherlist.com, look for Pitcher List Plus, and sign up now. But That's all for this week. We will be back next week with another episode of This Week in Fantasy Baseball. For John, I'm Lee, and we'll see you in the next one. Later, everyone.